lyrical lines of the poem last week, Donne's Nocturnal. That is going back, hearkening back to a time when part of the work of the philosopher was physical, still like putting hands on things and considering notions of physical being as well as mental being. And you know, part of the ongoing notion that I return to is the poem as a created object, a made thing, and that one can circle a poem and see it from different angles of perception. And although I have no longer much faith in this, nonetheless, the principle is that when you can handle a poem, one hopes, I used to hope, that you'd be able to handle other subtleties in the world and not be rushing to judgment, but understand the grander glories of youth and beauty. Yeah, right. Shelley is a very modest fellow here, and in some ways, Shelley is in that in the vanguard of a real changing attitude towards the poem. The poet is becoming less part of, how to phrase this correctly, he's being squeezed out of mainstream society. He's being looked upon as just a troublemaker. And I think Shelley played that up, and I think that Shelley is an advance as a revolutionary, as an early anarchist and vegetarian. Shelley was saying that it is the duty of the poet to criticize and to look at the wrongs and injustices of society. And so, you know, we see that whole beginning of the role of the individual in the poet, the emphasis on originality, which really takes over later in the 19th century, but I think it's part of it's going on there. And that whole question of the old, the tradition, I think that Shelley has plugged into some of the traditions, some of the alchemical and mystical traditions of the poet and the magical quality of what it is to make a poem. It is, for me, an easy step from Elizabethan lyrics to Shelley, and I really think that Shelley should be a constant source. Check a gauge, as it were, for your daily responses. Shelley is has a special claim to fame as being in that generation of English poets, the first generation of English poets to really be reading Dante. And I think that's important for me. I think that I need say no more. Shelley's sincerity is a question. I don't doubt that he is sincere, and I think that it is probably fair to say that he always believes what he is saying. This is really, shall we say, a little different from Byron, I suppose. Byron's a lot funnier. And for those of you who feel that the main problem with poetry today is that it has no sense of humor, well, that's probably just plain wrong, but I would recommend that you take a good look at Byron and just see how funny a good poem can be. But it would not be right to say that Shelley has no sense of humor. It is not as strong a feature in his makeup as it is with Byron. But I find, as I return to this poem, that there is something very charming and humorous about it. Humorous, perhaps in an Elizabethan sense, in that there is a charm to Shelley and a modesty to Shelley, which is admirable, and perhaps may be an example to us all. Now, under the brand new lighting conditions created by the ever wonderful and omnipresent T-Dub, I am able to read this today without having to see my way feelingly. But of course, the other factor in any reading is just how good is the voice this morning. Well, we'll soon see. I will pause for a few moments of disgusting hacking and clearing, and then return with a poem that does cover subtle notions. That whole quality of the poem is dealing with finer distinctions. Something that I think Shelley, again, is blazing. Although, it would be interesting to see whether what Shelley's knowledge of Donne was. You know, all these poets, they have their rising and their falling in the terms of the literary fame market. And so there he is when Dante is being reintroduced. Well, I guess you could say introduced to the English reading public. Where was Donne at this time? You know, and I think that a great deal of what should be taught in literary appreciation is the give and take of generations of poets, how they have learned and how they have rejected things from the past. But that is, I suspect, neither here nor there. Hymn to Intellectual Beauty by Percy Bysshe Shelley. Just twiddle our thumbs here for a few minutes, because things have to be done. That's the way it is now that WBAI is working full time. Things have to be done at any time. Meanwhile, I'll take this opportunity to say that Shelley was born in 1792 and died in 1822. His last words, glub dub drib. This poem was written in 1816, a time of great personal turmoil. And one of the things that Shelley should be thanked for was teaching Byron how to read Wordsworth. Hey, you think it's easy, huh? No. You have to learn all sorts of things if you want to get on as a poet. I've heard that story before, haven't I? Yeats and Pound made a pact to read all of Wordsworth one winter. Well, they plowed through it, but then I believe they fulfilled the pact by promising never to mention it again. All right, you hear the closing doors and the last of the ticks. You hear that constant hum of power that is WBAI. Well, put that all aside and consider a hymn to intellectual beauty. The awful shadow of some unseen power floats, though unseen, among us, visiting this various world with as inconstant wing as summer winds that creep from flower to flower. Like moonbeams that behind some piny mountain shower, it visits with inconstant glance each human heart and countenance, like hues and harmonies of evening, like clouds and starlight widely spread, like memory of music fled, like aught that for its grace may be dear, and yet dearer for its mystery. Spirit of beauty, that dost consecrate with thine own hues all thou dost shine upon of human thought or form, where art thou gone? Why dost thou pass away and leave our state, this dim, vast veil of tears, vacant and desolate? Ask why the sunlight not forever weaves rainbows o'er yon mountain river, why aught should fail and fade that once is shown. Why fear and dream and death and birth cast
on the daylight of this earth, such gloom. Why man has such a scope for love and hate, despondency and hope. No voice from some sublimer world hath ever to sage or poet these responses given. Therefore the names of demon, ghost, and heaven remain the records of their vain endeavor, frail spells whose uttered charm might not avail to sever from all we hear and all we see doubt, chance, and mutability. Thy light alone, like mist o'er mountains driven, or music by the night wind sent through strings of some still instrument, or moonlight on a midnight stream, gives grace and truth to life's unquiet dream. Love, hope, and self-esteem, like clouds, depart and come for some uncertain moments lent. Man were immortal and omnipotent, didst thou, unknown and awful as thou art, keep with thy glorious train firm state within his heart. Thou messenger of sympathies that wax and wane in lovers' eyes, thou that to human thought art nourishment like darkness to a dying flame, depart not as thy shadow came. Depart not, lest the grave should be like life and fear, a dark reality. While yet a boy, I sought for ghosts, and sped through many a listening chamber, cave and ruin and starlight wood, with fearful steps pursuing hopes of high talk with the departed dead. I called on poisonous names with which our youth is fed. I was not heard. I saw them not. Yet, musing deeply on the lot of life, at that sweet time when winds are wooing all vital things that wake to bring news of birds and blossoming, sudden thy shadow fell on me, and I vowed that I would dedicate my powers to thee and thine. Have I not kept the vow? With beating heart and streaming eyes, even now I call the phantoms of a thousand hours, each from his voiceless grave. They have envisioned bowers of studious zeal or love's delight, outwatched with me the envious night. They know that never joy loomed my brow unlinked with hope that thou wouldst free this world from its dark slavery, that thou, O awful loveliness, wouldst give whate'er these words cannot express. The day becomes more solemn and serene when noon is past. There is a harmony in autumn and a luster in its sky, which through the summer is not heard or seen, as if it could not be, as if it had not been. Thus let thy power, which like the truth of nature on my passive youth descended, to my onward life supply its calm. To one who worships thee, and every form containing thee, whom spirit fair thy spells did bind to fear himself and love all humankind.
Hymn to Intellectual Beauty by Bysshe Shelley. To human thought art nourishment, like darkness to a dying flame. A recurring image for Bysshe, an ember. And the imagination is like that ember, too. Well, the only point of imagination, I suppose, is being able to use it. And one could always say that there are plenty of things to imagine if you put your mind to it. Let's see what we got in the Charlie Parker songbook. Another hairdo. That sounds promising. 2 minutes and 34th take, December 21st, 1947. Okay, there you go, 1947. Oh, yes. But Constellation was 1948. Okay, 1947. December 21st, 1947. The fourth take of Another Hairdo. If you're very good, maybe I'll play the three preliminary takes of Another Hairdo. 15 seconds, 45 seconds, and a minute four. Well, that sounds pretty good, doesn't it? However, first, the final take, and then we'll just see, won't we?
Thank you.
Mighty fine indeed. You're listening to As I Please over WBAI New York City, 99.5 on your FM dial. Yes, we are here. We are still here. We may not be here forever, but that depends a good deal on you. The address here is As I... I'm not going to give the address because all only people who write are those who sit around... one would think that after all these years, you'd at least attempt to use language, in, shall we say, to its higher calling. And speaking of higher calling, somebody is calling me to get out of here, and I imagine that's a good thing for all concerned, but I have 10 minutes left, and one of the things I want to do in 10 minutes is to give you this. Now, this is a live recording. I know there are some people out there actually complain about live recordings. My goodness gracious. Oh, lighten up, comrades. Lighten up. You know, we're all dying. Can't we have a little bit of a good time once in a way? This is a live recording, I guess a World War II vintage, but it's really very interesting. Listen to the tenor saxophone. You will learn a great deal from the following. Next up, Woodside.
And now, Count, we still have time on this little jive session for that famous jump tune of yours, Jumping at the Woodside. Did you bring the music along?
Well, Jim, we've been playing the Woodside so long we don't need to see the notes.
Well, in that case, how's it?
Smooth, wasn't it? Entirely unintentional. I would not interrupt Count Basie, not even as a talkover, not to break a station, not nothing. But there we are. Oh, it's magically recued itself. As though we were going to... Oh, now it's stuck. Oh! I know. Now. Well, it would be nice and smooth, as now we have to break a CD machine in order for me to retrieve my CD. Well, I guess this is yet another way of reminding you that pretty soon BAI is going to go on the air and asking for money. Now, I know we have betrayed your trust a zillion times. We'll probably do it again. But, you know, maybe one of these days we could do an equipment-only fundraiser. Go to not to the people here, but to the hard-working things that are as broken down as, well, just about as the rest of us. Any case, you have been listening to As I Please this morning. I'm going to leave now because there's nothing else I can do except say goodbye. Until next time, y'all take it easy, but make sure you take it.
I want to relate a yarn. Turn back the pages of history and what do you see? Madison Square Garden or Odeo. And there I was, interviewing a prize-winning cow. I asked her to tell the radio public how she feels. She said, moo. She's contented. I'm contented, but her husband ain't. So what happens? The bull ups to me. I ups to him, and without any preliminaries, I'm flat on my back. Being a gentleman, I apologize. But the bull's not satisfied. He demands an autopsy. So I grab him by the tail, and what happens? He flips his tail. I lands on his head. He flips his head. I lands on his tail. He's playing ping pong with me, and I'm losing. Just then, the bull is ready to charge again. I gets an idea. I start singing, south to the border, down Mexico way. And what happens? The bull starts crying. But irregardless, I keeps on singing. This time with the castanets. That's too much for the bull. He collapses. A cheer goes up. I'm saved. And the moral is, you gotta start off each day with a song. You gotta start off each day with a song.
Oh boy, you're singing loud.
Even when things go wrong.
Oh Jimmy, you're a wow.
You feel better. You know, I'm walking down Broadway and who taps me on the shoulder? My pal hit him in the head, Schwartz. I said, who are you working for now? And he said, the same bunch, the wife and the kids. Now, isn't it better to go through life with a smile and a song than walking around with a face 11 miles long? Now you know that you can't go wrong.
Yeah.
If you start off each day with a song.
That's James Durante, and I'm David Rothenberg, and this is Saturday morning, and that's a cushion being put under my tushy. Thank you very much, so I can reach the microphone. Being 5'7 in a studio that you haven't been in for a month has some acclimating to do. Is that a word? Talking about words, did you know that hello was a noun? I checked that. I was wondering. I couldn't imagine what figure of speech hello was. I thought it might be a verb, but it's a noun. I'm sure that news shatters you and inspires you. It's Saturday morning, the 19th of January. I'm David Rothenberg. As I was saying before I was rudely interrupted a month ago, what did I want to tell you? Oh, it's very nice out. It's cool. It's a cold winter day. It's cloudy. The threat of snow, the first of the year for the metropolitan New York area, is promised for us this afternoon, but we'll see what happens. Sam Rivera hasn't come in yet. I wonder if he's taking care of the twins. Since you last heard Sam Rivera, he became the father of two boys, Jason and Jaden. Jaden David is both 4 pounds, 6 ounces. I think they're home from the hospital now. I told them because Jaden's middle name is David, he will be in the will. Here's the Weavers with an appropriate song.
I woke up this morning with my mind.
My mind, it was stayed on freedom.
I woke up this morning with my mind.
My mind, it was stayed on freedom.
I woke up this morning with my mind.
My mind, it was stayed on freedom.
Walking and talking with my mind.
My mind, it was stayed on freedom.
I was walking and talking with my mind.
My mind, it was stayed on freedom.
I was walking, I was talking, talking with my mind.
It was stayed on freedom.
Hallelujah.
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 Thinking and moving with my mind.
My mind, it was
and moving with your mind.
My mind, it was stayed on freedom.
Freedom now, thinking and moving with
my mind. It was stayed on freedom.
Hallelujah.
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 Walk, 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 walk,
walk, walk
with my mind on freedom.
Walk, 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 walk
with my mind on freedom. Hallelujah. I met my brother on the street. He had a smile on his face. With his mind on freedom. Now I met my sister on the street. She had a smile on her face. And her mind on freedom. Hallelujah.
My mind, it was stayed on
The Weavers on a Saturday morning with David Rothenberg. During the last week, many of us learned how to find 99.5 on our dial again, retuning to WBAI and hearing wonderful programs after a 13-month hiatus. I wanted to read for you a essay which I wrote and read on the air this summer, which I think might still be worth listening to. I hope it is. A couple of people asked if I would reconsider reading it, and my arm has been twisted. Here's what I said back in late July, early August. From time to time, I've cited William Shire's book, The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, one of the most influential and important books in my lifetime of reading. I was well familiar with the horror stories, the endless atrocities committed by the Nazis, but I wanted to understand all of the aspects which permitted Hitler to rise to power, the historic precedents, the political, the religious, psychological, and economic climate that saw a people allowing a tyrant to take on the world to satisfy some peculiar sick need. And of course, we've seen traces of that in other parts of the world, some successful, others sputtering out in its infancy. During the Giuliani years, I've often cited Shire's book, only to be the recipient of sharp criticism, mostly saying that I besmirched memory of Holocaust victims by such glib comparisons. I certainly did not compare Giuliani's reign in New York with Final Solutions. But if we're to learn anything from the rise of Hitler, as Shire outlines in his brilliant book, it's to recognize the traits that exist when a tyrant takes over a country, a city, a corporation, or a nonprofit organization. What did I learn from the rise and fall of the Third Reich? One, nearly every government or corporate enterprise has a shadow ruling body, industrialists or boards of directors who work behind the scenes, who are the continuing power brokers, who want government to run smoothly, conveying the sense of democracy, but always protecting the privileged and the powerful and the controllers of the purse strings. They could be manufacturers or real estate empire kings, or a board of directors. When there's a crisis, economic or a sense of control being lost or a political edge being diminished, the power brokers seek out a strong personality to take control and put things back into shape, usually with a blank check until it gets out of hand. Sometimes it goes way beyond what the industrialists need, and that's when bloodshed happens. There is always a law and order personality in the crowd, someone with deep psychological, sometimes pathological needs to be fulfilled, to take charge and to be all-powerful. History has recorded such individuals and their rapid rise and their inevitable falls. If you follow the blueprint of the rise and fall of the Third Reich, you discover that the rising tyrant needs a number of things in place, all interrelated and to be acted upon together. That would be, one, a scapegoat or scapegoats, two, a military or security control that's justified because of the alleged threat of the scapegoats, and three, the elimination of charismatic opposition, holders of the democratic process. All of this is with the silent approval of the power brokers, the economic controllers. We don't have to paint the picture that Hitler and the Krupp Empire drew, but look at Giuliani's administration. The scapegoats were defined in a number of ways. It was clearly perceived to be young black males. They were the police targets. No naysayers were permitted in the Giuliani administration. It did not and has not represented the diversity of the city. And the blocking off of City Hall reflected a bunker mentality. Our checks and balances and reasonably free press and due process put a rein on much of Giuliani's terror, but his inclinations were clear and is why his administration frightened me. And then we come to the takeover of this station, a small blip in the political scheme of things, but a voice that was heard with much interest by the Democratic Party during the elections, when too much time was justifying third-party realities. Pacifica and WBAI specifically could be held responsible for marginal voters going to Nader, throwing the election to Bush. With a former chair of the board closely tied to the outgoing administration, the Clinton administration, and still the puller of the strings at Pacifica, and 3 weeks after the Supreme Court ruled that George Bush would be president, some draconian changes took place at this little outlet at WBAI. A scapegoat was found, she the interviewer of Bill Clinton on Election Day, she who had Ralph Nader as a partner during the GOP convention. The charismatic people's voices were dismissed without warning, and the security system went into place. And the sole criteria for being on the decision-making is loyalty to the chief. Talents long abandoned or overlooked rose to the top, just as Rudolf Hess did in the Third Reich. For the sole measure of visibility or audibility was loyalty and joining in the scapegoating. I've attempted to abide by the gag rule imposed on us, but when I hear continual slander about my colleagues, I feel that the gag rule is tantamount to remaining silent during the rise of the Third Reich. Amy Goodman has been verbally and now physically abused at this station. Bernard White's name and professional skills has been assaulted by persons who quite candidly can't hold a candle to his talents. The interim manager of this station is irrationally obsessed by Amy Goodman, her reportorial skills, her large following, and the accolades that she has received. An abuse of Amy is the sole criterion for a place at the table on this station now, and slavish obedience is what is expected. I find that that is integral. Very confused, never-defined motives are revealed as power is relished for itself, but always forgotten for those who ignore history is that for every rise of a Third Reich, it is followed by a fall. Stay tuned and pay close attention. I read that last, it was either late July or early August, and people called and said to me afterwards, why weren't you fired? And I said, I think the reason I wasn't fired is because Utrecht doesn't listen to the station, certainly in the mornings, on Saturdays, and I may never have heard it. I was called in a couple of weeks later for a discussion that had nothing to do with that. But one of the interesting things is that when she was the interim station manager, when she took over, she, I should clarify this, but way before the, well, let me begin by saying that it is not my intention to belabor this. I've listened to the station all week, and many of us have had a need, with the gag rule off, to talk about what happened. I think it's because once you lance a boil and the pus comes out, you want to make sure all the pus is out before the scab is formed and the healing truly begins. And I think many of us who have been appalled by what happened here, outraged, feel a need to cleanse the air before we move on, because the air must be cleansed. And a statement of candor, before the coup of December 22nd, 2000, I made it clear that I was torn between, and what really seemed to be a dispute between Bernard White and Utrecht Lead, both whom I considered colleagues and both whom I respected professionally, and went to both and suggested that we sit down and talk, and I would join with them. In my last discussion with Utrecht Lead, she agreed that she would do that if Bernard would, and then 2 days later was took over the station, which clearly, when she met with me, she had already put this into motion. And the sense of betrayal that I felt, that's the emotion that's so painful. Betrayal is a devastating emotion, and I had felt betrayed by her, because I had considered myself a friend and colleague, and was hopefully, I felt a little like Chamberlain with the umbrella coming back, trying to make peace when war was underway. She became interim station manager and did not spend much time doing that, which is one of the reasons why the station fell into great economic disarray. She was playing the role of station manager and program director, and you can't do both. Let me, for those of you who are not intricately familiar with the whole structure, WBAI is part of a network of 5 stations, one in New York, Washington, Houston, LA, and Berkeley, and they're part of the Pacifica Network, which is a nonprofit started by a man named Lou Hill over 40 years ago with a to progressive and pacifist politics. It is nonprofit, is listener-sponsored, and a board of directors oversees the 5 stations, and in the mid-90s was taken over. But what I see is representatives of the centrist wing of the Democratic Party who felt that it was perfectly all right for WBAI and other stations to be critical of Republicans in power, but not of the Democrats. And that's, I think, part of what the problem was. And then on a local level, people who had a need for power matched up and merged nicely with the agenda put in by the political centrists that were running the board, that took over the board in the mid-90s and reached a climax in the end of the 20th century. And that's and then the takeover and the silencing of dissenting voices from a station that prided itself on free speech became the mantra here, and it was curious. And about on the anniversary of the coup, I, with a new interim manager, Utrecht Sleet had been moved to Washington, who was made national program director, a curious post since there were no national programs except for the news, which had a news director, and Democracy Now!, which had been taken off the air. So she was, in fact, given a job for which there was no purpose. And then her resignation was accepted, and that was the end of Utrecht, one would think, although Mimi Rosenberg says she's a little like Glenn Close at the end of Fatal Attraction. You think she's underwater and she keeps resurfacing. Anyway, Bob Daughtry was brought up from operations in Washington, was made the interim director here, called me in shortly after he took over, said he didn't understand my program, said one moment you're talking about prisons and the next minute you're reading a book, talking about a book or a movie, there doesn't seem to be any focus. And he suggested that he was going to bring in a radio instructor to help me to professionalize the program. I pointed out that the magazine format was famous in radio, and the absence of that professional sound with voices that sound like God from a well has not been identified with WBAI. In fact, that the truth is, when I used to listen to my tapes, I couldn't imagine why anybody would bother to listen to me until I found out that people liked the fact that I sounded like somebody next door rather than the voice of WABC. Anyway, Bob Daughtry did not like what I said a month ago when I talked about the fiscal situation at Pacifica and that the station had lost $3 million, and I outlined it, all of which was revealed in last week's three-day board meeting that was aired when Bob Daughtry was forced to play the second 2 days on air for the listeners. He sent me a fax after he suspended me, said, I am suspending you from your weekly program on Saturday for your irresponsible and extended tirade on the show December 22nd. I would like to meet with you to discuss the reasons for your suspension and whether or not you can return to the air. Please call my office at your earliest convenience so we can set up an acceptable time we can meet. I sent Mr. Daughtry the following letter. This is to acknowledge receipt of the memo which you FedExed to me with the official pronouncement of my suspension. Your invitation to meet with you would certainly be considered if there was an attempt to explain the dual criteria for the gag rule at WBAI. On the week that I was suspended for offering my candid views of Pacifica's fiscal plight, there was also a program hosted by Earl Caldwell and Jabel Fay in which my former colleagues Juan Gonzalez, Bernard White, and Amy Goodman were thoroughly attacked. It seems as if the gag rule exists not to prevent discussion of WBAI and Pacifica's policies, but only one perspective. Also, I consider returning to the air if you would be my guest on the first program to discuss the issues which I raised and also to discuss the gag rule and the bannings which have taken place. I'm also curious why you would FedEx me a memo when a fax, a phone call, or even a letter would have been less expensive. Clearly, our views on WBAI and Pacifica's financial needs differ at many levels. Cordially, David Rothenberg. He never answered that letter. And so it came that there was a three-day boom last week, and one of the reasons I'm compelled to talk is because even after the board meeting, which many of you attended, hundreds, there was an overflow crowd. The room fit about 400 or 500 people, and there was standing room only, a couple of hundred people not able to get in. But the lies continued. The week before the three-day national board meeting, in which all of this was to be assessed, the gag rule at WBAI, the firings, the around of the five stations, on the air here, nonstop were pleading, begging people to come out and support those that had taken over the station. It was almost embarrassing, and I didn't listen to it that much. It became tiresome, as much of the radio in the last year had become. urging people to come out. So when I arrived at the board meeting, standing in line with hundreds of other people, security guards telling us who could get in and who couldn't. Most of us who got there 20 minutes early did get in. I was surprised that when Eutrice and Marjorie Moore arrived, about 10 people stood up and applauded, and I suddenly realized that in a year on the air, they had no constituency. That 500 people standing in and sitting in this hall, 95% were there to in support of the people who had been ousted. Bernard White, Nate Goodman, and Janice K. Bryan, and Sharan Harper, and Robert Knight, and the list goes on. Well, Bob Fass, who am I missing? Dred Scott, me eventually. That the overwhelming number of people were for the people that had been ousted, that they hadn't established a constituency with a year on the radio. And then on Monday morning, following the board meeting, after the board dismissed Bob Daughtry and reinstated Valerie Van Isler as the station manager and Bernard White as program director, the listeners were told that it was a setup, that only certain people were allowed in. The guards downstairs were security guards who had no way of knowing who anybody was. The simple fact was there was an overwhelming constituency for the disenfranchised, the fired, the suspended. People were suspended, fired, banned, or preempted. And poor Bessie Machami, whose program was taken away from him, said that he was denied the sanctity of title. He was neither banned nor suspended, nor fired, nor preempted. He just didn't have a program. They merely took it away from him. So there were many different categories in which people were dismissed. But the lie continued after. When you consider that a middle of the night changing of the locks takeover was on one side, and a 3-day open board meeting broadcast, and we had to force them to broadcast. Daughtry was ordered by the board to start broadcasting the program, the 3-day board meeting, didn't do it on Friday night, did on Saturday and Sunday. A democratic process, open, with hundreds and hundreds of people cheering for the changes and the restoring of the station to the people who had run it before December 22nd in the year 2000. But the lies continued. Some of the lies during the year, and I just want to get this out because many of you are casual listeners, not caught up in it as many of us are. And many of the listeners and people on air and behind-the-scenes people at the station, every time somebody called in and tried to say something before somebody said, say goodbye, they were referred to as a handful of dissidents. It made it seem as just a handful of dissidents were calling in to protest. And I went to a potluck supper at the Union Hall on the day that I was suspended last December, and 1,200 people paid $15 to support the then outcasts. That didn't sound like, I looked around the room and said, that's not a handful of dissidents. That's a lot of people who are concerned about free speech and a radio station that was taken away from them in a barbaric manner. So what we have now is a return to the people and a mandate that they have to come up with the kind of radio that we were used to, which included free speech on the air. The real reason for the fall was that in addition to the lust for power that was revealed here, there was an economic malfeasance, a financial failure, in which the Pacifica board in 1 year ran up a $3 million deficit, and that came out at the board meeting. It's what I revealed on the show that caused me to be suspended, in which they spent money for which there was no budget. Now, I was an executive director at the Fortune Society for 17 years, and I knew that if our board wanted to give raises to 6 people, and it amounted to $5,000 a person, and it's 6 people, and that meant $30,000 over the year, we couldn't do it until money was raised for that. We had to find money before we spent it. the people at Pacifica in the last year spent $3 million for which they didn't have a budget. $250,000 for a public relations firm, and I may add, to get back to my theory about the Democratic Party, the same public relations firm that represented the Democrats during the Lewinsky-Clinton hearings. They spent $1 million on law firms against because of the suits brought up by listeners around the country. The law firm, the same firm that represented the Democratic Party during the Lewinsky-Clinton hearings. And that and $50,000 or more for security at the station so we could be watched. And I was told for months that I was being monitored, that my programs were being taped and listened to. A comforting thought. The end result is, by the way, one other thing about about the dollars and cents is that during the last fundraising drive, we were never told how much was being raised. One of the things that has always been part of the BAI fundraising is tell the staff, the listeners, how much the goal was and how much was being raised. I remember the first fundraiser I listened to on BAI, I think it was Steve Post, who set a criterion for how much money was to be raised. And he said, if I need $5,000, if I don't reach my goal, I'm going to play Kate Smith singing God Bless America. And he played it over and over and over again. And I remember, as an early BAI listener, thinking, nobody's going to keep this radio on listening to Kate Smith singing God Bless America. Little did I know about the devotion of the BAI listeners. Not only did they stay tuned, they matched his request just so that they could stop hearing Kate Smith sing God Bless America. Well, in the last fundraising drive, we were told we raised $1 million. It took them a year to do it, but we never knew. Not even the people back there answering the phones. The slips that of the pledges were gathered and then brought into Politburo headquarters, and nobody knew what the total was. It was the secrecy was incredible. And the way people vanished around here, do you remember those pictures during the Stalin years when the Daily News would run a picture, two pictures of the Politburo standing at the Kremlin? There'd be 12 people in the picture on the right, and then the picture on the left, there'd be 11, and there'd be a circle, and you know that Molotov was no longer there? That's what happened here. They were swallowing their own. For almost a year, I was listening to Santiago Nieves was on in the morning as the one of the hosts for what was Wake Up Call. Suddenly he wasn't there. He vanished. He was fired. But no mention. It was just he was gone. And it was a curious. That's the roundup of what was. What happened this week for me is I started listening to BAI solidly again. The radio was just on at 99.5. During the last year, I'd make my tea in the morning and I'd put on QXR and then I'd slip over and I'd inhale and exhale with Marjorie Moore and then I'd say, enough. And I'd get back to QXR. I inhaled enough. And so I then started listening this week and two dramatic things happened to me. First, very personal, and that's why I was excited. First, listening to Wake Up Call Tuesday morning, and hear that I came down here. And for the whole year, we would.